Thank you for listening to this sermon from Arapahoe Road Baptist Church. We hope you enjoy the teaching of Dr. David Rogers, lead pastor of Arapahoe Road. For more information about our church and its ministries, please visit arapahoeroad.org. And now, here's Pastor David Rogers.
Who do you say I am? That is the most important question to be posed to humanity for all time. I mean, there will never, ever be another question that rivals the gravity and the consequence of that question right there. Who do you say I am? Now, we're going to face a whole lot of pretty weighty questions throughout the course and scope of our life. I mean, there's some tough questions that are going to come our way, some big questions that are going to come our way. Questions like, who am I going to marry? Where am I going to live? What's going to be my course of study at college? What kind of career am I going to focus on? What am I going to do in my golden years? Big questions, serious questions, questions that have some weight behind them. But no human being ever will be faced with a more poignant question with such eternal ramifications than the one that Jesus posed to his disciples on that day in Caesarea Philippi. The scene is found in Matthew chapter 16. Why don't you take your Bible or turn on your Bible to Matthew 16. If you're using the Bible in the row in front of you, the scene that we're going to look at today is on page 822. If you don't have a Bible of your own, when we're finished this morning, come see me down front and I'll make sure that you get a Bible that you can take home with you. We've got several that we'd love to give away. In Matthew chapter 16, we're going to pick up this scene in verse 13, and we're going to read this story that we heard an account of on the video this morning. So hopefully you found Matthew 16. We'll pick up in verse 13. It says this: Now when Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, "Who do people say that the Son of Man is?" And they said, "Well, some say John the Baptist, and others say Elijah, and others, Jeremiah, or one of the prophets." He said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" Simon Peter replied, "You're the Christ, the Son of the living God." And Jesus answered him, "Blessed are you, Simon Barjona, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who's in heaven. And I tell you, you are Peter. And on this rock I'll build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. I'll give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven." And then he strictly charged the disciples to tell no one that he was the Christ. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Man, as we ponder the all-important question that Jesus asked to his disciples on that day, we also must take note of something. We need to take note of the setting that conversation took place. Let's really try this morning to use the imagination that God has given us, and we'll look at some pictures on the screen here in a few minutes, but let's do our very, very best to actually place ourselves, to put ourselves in the sandals of the disciples on that day that Jesus was having this conversation with his disciples, because I really believe that maybe you've heard that story a lot of times. Maybe this is the very first time you've ever heard that story, but I'm telling you, there are some things that are happening in the scenery, in the atmosphere, in the location that Jesus had this conversation with his disciples on that day, that when you begin to see it and you begin to really find yourself sitting amongst the 12 disciples and listening to Jesus, it may come to life for you in a different way than it ever has before. Let me show you what I'm talking about. This passage starts off that we read in verse 13. Look how it starts off again. It says, "Now when Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi." Let me show you kind of where Caesarea Philippi is on this map. So this is a map over here of Israel, and Caesarea Philippi is in the far northern part. It would be the far northern boundary of the promised land of Israel. It would have taken Jesus and his disciples about 2 days' walk. You see where the arrow is there? Just go down and you see that first body of water there, the Sea of Galilee? That's where Jesus did most of his ministry. That's about a 25-mile walk from the Sea of Galilee up to Caesarea Philippi. It would have taken Jesus and his disciples about 2 days to make that walk. It's at the base. Caesarea Philippi is at the base of a mountain called Mount Hermon. And they likely made their way from the Sea of Galilee up to the northern part of Israel at Caesarea Philippi to escape the heat of a couple of different heats. One would just be the heat, the mugginess, the humidity. Probably kind of felt like Houston around the Sea of Galilee, where it's just kind of hot and thick and muggy. And not only did they escape that heat going up toward the north where the mountains were, they also were escaping the heat of just some of the religious leaders and the crowds who were starting to press in on Jesus as his popularity began to grow. They just wanted to step out of that pressure cooker, that heat for a little bit, and just be with his buddies, be with his disciples. Now, it's really helpful to understand the layout at Caesarea Philippi, to understand the backstory of what was happening in that particular region that Jesus and his disciples found themselves in this part of the story. So let's dive a bit deeper into the story below the surface of the text, and let's try to understand the surroundings that this story is situated within that makes what Jesus is saying on that day to his disciples really come to life. Because when you understand where it's being said, you begin to see some things that maybe you didn't see the first time or the 51st time that you've heard or read this story. See, if we can understand the surroundings that Jesus and his disciples are passing through as they're walking into and through Caesarea Philippi, you'll begin to see, wow, what he has to say is really pertinent where we are. Because see, where they are in Caesarea Philippi, up in the very northern part of the promised land of Israel, they're passing through an incredibly pagan, saturated town. And all of a sudden, we're beginning to see with them, wow, there's a conversation that's happening, and there's a whole lot of other belief systems that are all around them. There's a whole lot of other things being worshipped, and people being worshipped, and gods being worshipped in the one true God. You see, Caesarea Philippi originally was known as the city of Panias. Panias. It was named after the Greek god Pan. The conquest of a guy named Alexander the Great. Raise your hand if you've ever heard of that guy before. Alexander the Great conquered lands all over that region. And everywhere Alexander the Great went, he imported Greek language and Greek culture everywhere he went. And because this particular area in Caesarea Philippi, in that part of northern Israel, was so lush, there was so much vegetation. There were great streams and rivers that were flowing in that surrounding region. That particular place was identified as an ideal place of worship to this Greek god named Pan. Pan was also known as the god of the shepherds and the flocks and nature. Thus, this area known as Panias means Pan's place. According to pagan mythology, Pan took the form of a being that was half goat, half human, that played the flute. The type of flute became known as the pan flute. Maybe you've heard of that. And legend has it, this is very important to our story today. Legend has it that Pan was born in a cave. And this is what Caesarea Philippi looks like today. Do you see that cave there in the side of that big rocky face of a mountain? Yeah, there's a cave there. This is what Caesarea Philippi looks like today, also known as Panias. Allison and I had the opportunity to go there when we were in the Holy Land a couple of years ago. And I'm telling you, once I stepped into that place and stepped into that story of Matthew 16, I began to see some things that just reading the scripture I never saw before. I began to understand some things in a different way that I never understood before. It came to life for me. See, at the base of this ascending rock quarry where Panias is located is a cave. There's that cave right there. You see people looking into that cave who were visiting Caesarea Philippi on that day. Out of that cave, you can't see it too well, but there are waters that are flowing out of that cave. And it flowed out on through the surrounding area. Now, this is very important to realize. Remember, we're putting ourselves in the story with Jesus and his disciples. It's very important to remember that some people considered places where water flowed out of caves to be an entry point into the abode of the dead, also known as Hades, or the underworld, or Sheol, as maybe you've heard it called before. Nevertheless, the waters flowed from the mouth of this cave at Panias and on down through the surrounding area that really made for this beautiful and life-giving scene. I mean, look at this next picture. In the side of the rock, you see those different little hollowed out spaces, hewn out spaces. Some of you may have a space in your home where it's called an art niche, and you put a little piece of art in there, a picture in there. Well, in the side of the mountain, you can still see these today. These hollowed out places are where they would, hang on, go back one more. These hollowed out places are where they would put sculpted idols, hewn idols, chiseled out idols of the Greek god Pan, and they would worship him there. It would remind him, oh, this is where we think Pan was born, in that cave right next to us. Now, go to that next slide there, and you'll see this is an artist's rendering of what they think Caesarea Philippi or Panias looked like back in Jesus' day. You see where the cave is, but there's this big temple built in front of it. That temple would have had the river flowing into the temple and then on out to symbolize life is in this place. That temple right there on the far left would have been a place where people could go and worship the emperor of Rome at the time, Caesar Augustus. And then the waters protrude from the cave, flowing out of the temple, representing the symbol of life. Next to that temple, you see the court right there where people are gathered. You see the little hewn out places in the side of the rock. That's the court where they would worship the idols of Pan. And then next to that temple, or next to that little court, you see another temple. That temple was built for the god Zeus, who was the king of the Greek gods. That's the influence of that day. That's what people think it would have looked like in that time. And all of this is located at the base of Mount Hermon. Go to that next slide and you can see here. It's all at the base of Mount Hermon. Now, the temples aren't there anymore, but the cave still is, the river still is, the hewn out places where they used to worship Pan still is. And this is all the backdrop to Panias, Pan's place, Caesarea Philippi. Now, with that in mind, imagine Jesus and his disciples walking into that city as Jewish men, into all that paganism that's radically different than what they believe in the one true God.
Imagine Jesus and his disciples walking into this occupied city that has Roman political and military trappings that are just filled with reminders of pagan worship and idolatry. And all of this idolatry is located within the confines of Israel, the promised land that God had given to the Israelites, given to Moses way back when in the Old Testament. It's in God's land. This is in God's land. This idolatry is in God's land. With all that's in God's land, most Jews in the land are longing for a Messiah to arrive and eradicate all that. Wipe that out. Move them out. Heck, build a wall if you have to and kick them out to keep them out. And they longed for that kind of a Messiah. They were looking for a conquering hero to cleanse the land from all the idolatry, from all the pagan presence that had infiltrated and taken root in God's promised land. And this especially was the case in the far north region of Israel, close to the borders of their pagan neighbors. Now, Dr. Charles Dyer suggests maybe that's one reason that so many people struggled with Jesus, because they were looking for a Messiah who would come and who would be a sword wielding soldier, not a humble shepherd. See, Jesus didn't match their expectations. Perhaps that's why Jesus took his followers on this field trip from Galilee up to Caesarea Philippi, away from the pious masses and into the very heart of the pagan stronghold. This was the perfect spot for Jesus to quiz his disciples before he would begin to make his walk to Jerusalem and the cross. He wanted to make sure they understood who he was and why he had come. Kids, this is a great opportunity for you to draw me a picture. You've seen some of the pictures. Draw me your picture of what you think the scenery looked like when Jesus is sitting there with his disciples having this conversation with his friends. Who do you say I am? Draw me the picture of the side of the mountain and the carved out places where the idols would have been, and the cave with the river and the temples and Jesus and his disciples. Now, let me tell you this, and I'll remind you in a little bit. Make sure you draw lots of little rocks wherever they're seated. And I'll tell you why in a few minutes. Draw me a picture, and when you're finished this morning, put it on my board out in the Home Life Center. I want to see what you think this scene looked like. Back to the scripture on the back half of verse 13, Jesus administers this quiz and the responses to the disciples. Look what it says in verses 13 and 14. Jesus asks his disciples, "Who do people say that the Son of Man is?" The Son of Man is how Jesus referred to himself. The Son of Man is a title of the Messiah who was to come, from Old Testament language, particularly Daniel 7. About verse 13 and 14. "Who do people say that the Son of Man is?" And they said, in a general way, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and others Jeremiah or one of the prophets." Okay, so Jesus, he starts this quiz in kind of a, it's kind of a group quiz. Anybody in here like group projects? Especially when you haven't done your homework and yet you still kind of get to be there and it's like, yeah, what she said. And then everybody gets the good grade if it's right. Yeah? They're kind of having a group quiz right here. Yeah, some called him a prophet. But the masses didn't really see him as the Messiah, although the masses were intrigued at his power for miracles, at his teaching, to really do and say some amazing things. See, remember, the people in biblical days, they just expected more when it came to the Messiah that they had in their mind, who was just going to clean house and make Israel be that promised land that they always thought it would be. But Jesus hadn't really been demonstrating that kind of power thus far. See, they'd been taught to expect a conquering king who would eradicate the oppressive Romans, cleanse the country of all the pagan influence. A true Messiah would deliver Israel from all her enemies and establish the kingdom on earth once and for all. But they didn't see that really happening with Jesus, and thus many in the crowds were going, "That guy's a prophet. He's a prophet gaining in popularity." And so that's the answer that they gave in this group think quiz in the first part of the conversation. But now Jesus moves from the general, from a group project, to eyes on your own paper. You ever had that? Like when it's everybody, you're kind of looking at the teacher, and then when she starts or he starts, kind of, what do you think? What do you? Then all of a sudden, man, I need to look back down at my paper and avert my eyes and not don't make eye contact. If you make eye contact, oh, she'll draw you into her tractor beam, and then you're dead. He turns the spotlight directly on them in verse 15. He said to them, "But who do you say I am?" What a question. What a question. Who do you say I am? What is your answer to my question? You got to own this. You got to put your name on the paper. This isn't a group project anymore. Now your response goes into the grade book. See, all of a sudden the conversation went from a general class discussion that you could just kind of, what he said, to taking it very personal. It's got your name on it. Men and women, salvation has a very personal perspective to it. The people sitting around you have their opinions about Jesus. But what do you as an individual think about who Jesus is? That's kind of a different question. Not we, you. And this is the supreme question that every person on earth must answer. It was the question that Jesus had been leading his disciples toward for 2.5 years as they had been following him. And now they're in the midst of this pagan town that they were passing through, and he asked that question, "Who do you say I am?" And after perhaps a moment or two of silence, with that question just hanging in the air, Simon Peter responds, as he usually did, as a representative for the entire group. Have you ever had a staring contest with somebody? You know, on three, 1, 2, 3. Peter never would have won. He always would have blinked because he just couldn't stand it. He had to blurt out. And he couldn't stand it any longer. He blinks, he gives his input. And the rest of his disciples are like, "Oh good, I knew if we just stared for a minute, he would pipe in." Verses 16 and 17, Simon Peter replied, "You're the Christ, the Son of the living God." And Jesus answered him, "Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah." Bar-Jonah means son of Jonah. "For flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven." Jesus was so encouraged at the response from Simon Peter. It was an indication that God the Father had opened the heart and opened the mind in Peter to understanding who Jesus really was. Nobody else had revealed this truth to Simon Peter. It was God the Father who had revealed who Jesus was to him in that moment. And he wasn't just a prophet, and he wasn't just a good man, and he wasn't just a great teacher. He was the Messiah, which means the Christ. And what Peter was saying, you're the true king. You are the one Israel has been waiting for, has been longing for. You're the one that the Psalms and the prophets have been talking about for ages. You're him. You're the one. And we may not realize it, but such a declaration was a huge risk to Peter and his disciples. Why? Because in that day, to say Jesus is Lord is to say Caesar is not. And it puts you in the crosshairs of Caesar and his army. They'll eradicate anybody who they deem as a threat to the lordship of Caesar. Jesus wanted his disciples to be at a place where they understood who he was and what he was about before they would carry on the mission that he had begun. That's why he said, don't tell anybody about this yet. It wasn't quite time. It was almost time, but it wasn't quite time. He had a few more things to galvanize in their hearts before we said, okay, and we'll get to some of those in this series. But right here, this conversation is the tipping point of Jesus' ministry. It's the primary purpose for why he came, and it is to reveal himself and to make a way for people to come back to holy God. And it would cost Jesus and eventually his disciples their very lives. Now remember, that's the backdrop of this story. Get a good look at that picture. See all the rocks? They find themselves standing in front of a massive rock quarry with little rocks littering all around as they're having this conversation. Remember, kids, be sure you're drawing lots of little rocks. Here's why. Let me show you. Imagine the next words that Jesus says to Simon Peter being said in this location where they are. Remember, Caesarea Philippi, base of Mount Hermon, which from a topographical standpoint is a massive rock quarry. All around are these smaller rocks. I picked this one up when I was at Caesarea Philippi. That rock right there may have been close to Jesus' conversation. And I just wonder if maybe this became an object lesson for Jesus to point to pick up as he makes his response to Simon Peter's confession. Now remember, also at the base of this rock, those caves that's there, the rivers coming out, would have been next to those temples where the idols were inserted, that were hewn out in the places. Pan is displayed there. All of this is in their sight line as Jesus keeps giving his response to what Simon Peter responded to the question, who do you say I am? And then he says this to Peter, and I tell you, you are Peter, verse 18. You're Peter, and on this rock I'll build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. I'll give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven. Now, it can't be proven nor disproven that Jesus is using this backdrop of the rocky face of this mountain and the quarry of stones as an object lesson for Simon Peter, but I wouldn't put it past him. Doesn't it make sense? But look into the text a little bit more. Let me show you something. Let me show you what's translated here. When he says, "You're Peter, and on this rock I'll build my church." You are Peter. Petros, P-E-T-R-A-S. Petros means little rock. You're the little rock. You're Peter. And on this rock, Petra, P-E-T-R-A, quarry of stones, I'm going to build my church. You're just a little rock, but I'm going to build it on a big rock. Jesus is the master of the object lesson. And Jesus very likely could have pointed all the stones all on the ground and at the side of the Mount Hermon as he responds to Peter. And then to follow suit, maybe he points to the cave with the stream of water coming forth and says, "And the gates of hell are not going to prevail against the church." Why would he say that? Because the rivers coming from caves in that day were viewed as a gateway into the underworld. And they're sitting there going, You know what some people have called that place right there? If you go over there today, what some people will call that place, if you walk up to it? It's the gates of hell. That cave's called the gates of hell. And can't you just see Jesus going, "You're Petros, a little rock. On the big rock, Petra, I'm going to build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it." It's interesting to note that a gate is not an offensive weapon. This was our gate in our home that we live in the first few years we moved in. There's a stairway that leads up to an upstairs game room. And when we moved in there, Jack was about 3 and Lucy was about 2. And stairs and little kids learning to walk aren't a good thing to commingle. And so this, we just slid this right there on the first step. That was a great gate. You know what it did? It kept them out. When we wanted to go up, we'd either just step over, open the gate, close the gate. But never once did I think, "Boy, what a great offensive weapon for war." Maybe a shield to hide behind. But I don't really think of, "I'm going to take and charge hell with a gate." No. Gates are meant to keep people locked in, locked up, away from freedom. Jesus didn't come to go on the defensive. Jesus came to go on the offensive, to rescue people behind the gate from what was holding them in. And Jesus just said, "Gates of hell aren't going to prevail against my church. I'm coming to bust them out." And Jesus tells Peter, I'm giving you the keys to the kingdom. He's talking about the authority that comes with being an apostle. And Jesus was giving Peter the authority as a leader of the disciples to continue leading the mission that Jesus came to begin. And Jesus is speaking directly to Peter and his disciples as a result of the confession to his ultimate question, "Who do you say that I am?" And in that moment, God the Father revealed to Simon Peter and the disciples who Jesus really was. And they were entrusted with this revelation just before Jesus would turn and make his final walk all the way to the cross. And the question that Jesus posed on that day in Caesarea Philippi is the question that remains for all of us today. Who do you say he is? Jesus says, who do you say I am? He's more than a prophet. He's more than a good man. He's more than a great teacher. He is indeed the one and only Messiah. He is the Christ. He is God, who is the Son of the living God. That is what the Bible teaches about who Jesus is. That is how I respond to that question of who do I say he is. But what we're talking about today is not who I say he is. It's who do you say that he is? Who do you say he is? Who do you say he is? Who do you say he is? This isn't a group question. This is an individual question. And if you say that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of the living God, the Lord of all, then let me follow that up and go, how's that being lived out in your life? Because what you say needs to be backed up with how you live, how you parent, how you work, how you date, how you study, how you surf online, how you sit down with your tax man and make sure it's all there. Don't hide anything. Why do I say that? Because the scripture says there's nothing that's concealed that's not going to be made known. So just live free. Come out from behind the gate and just live transparently in every area of your life. And when people ask you the motivation, why do you do that? Because of who I say he is. That's why. And because I'm no longer living behind the gate. I've been free. And it's changed everything. And just like Peter, if you do that, you know what that's going to do for you? It's going to put you at risk. Because that's very counter-culture. It certainly was in Caesarea Philippi, and it is in Garland, Texas. And your answer to the question, who do you say that I am, really is not so much answered by what you say, it's really answered by how you live. And so how will your lips and how will your life respond to that question this week and in the weeks that lead up to Easter Sunday? What a great opportunity today is, not only to think about that question, but to orient your life around an answer that demonstrates he's the Christ, the Son of the living God.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. Feel free to distribute this recording, but please do not sell or alter it in any way. For more information about Arapahoe Road Baptist Church, please visit our church website at arapahoeroad.org. Arapahoe Road Baptist Church is located at 2256 Arapahoe Road in Garland, Texas, with Sunday morning services at 9:30 a.m. Feel free to join us this week.